This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This is Claudia's O'Reilly Auto Parts story.
I had just moved to a new city and barely even knew where the grocery store was yet. When my car wouldn't start one morning, I didn't know who to ask about local shops. But I remembered a name from back home, O'Reilly Auto Parts. I called and they pointed me to a great mechanic just down the street. Now I feel a little more at home.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
We are back on Brew of the Blue. Hope everybody's doing well, staying safe, and I'm delighted to say joining me this Thursday for this edition is Dave Prentice, Liverpool Echo Sports Editor, a legend in this part of the world, David, and I think it'll be absolutely fair to say. How are you doing, mate?
Very, very well. I'm not sure I can live up to that kind of billing.
Oh, it's probably absolutely fair enough, I'd say, in that regard.
Well, but,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've got to be nice. Got to be nice to everyone who comes on here, gets up at this time to speak to me, Dave. But in all seriousness, how are you doing, mate? How are you finding things at the moment?
All right. I mean, like everybody, I think frustrated. You know, trying to do the job as best we can in very, very difficult circumstances. But you know, there are plus points. You know, obviously, you get to spend a lot more time at home with my wife and kids. We're actually having proper meal times every single evening now. You know, which we've not done for a long time, which is great. And other little positive spin-offs. I mean, the start of the year. An idea I've had for a long, long time about doing a book about, you know, some of my experiences, you know, sort of working in journalism for a time where journalism has changed quite dramatically, you know, so not just Merseyside, but, you know, the world at large. And started working on this book, had the guys at our place, as was Trinity Sports Media, obviously the publishing arm of The Echo, were very, very enthusiastic about it and encouraged me to do a version. I think initially it was going to be, you know, so basically, you know, Everton, Liverpool and Tranmere, because I've covered all three during my time, but they weren't interested in that. They actually wanted an Everton one, you know, because obviously that's what I'm more closely, you know, sort of aligned to. Obviously, I am a Blue, which is why I'm on this. And I think they saw it as being something similar to Brian Reid's, you know, 43 years with the same bird. And so obviously that was music to my ears, you know, wanting to do something just about Everton, you know, alone. So I've been getting really stuck into that. I think they wanted about 80,000 words, ideally by the end of July. I think I'm 75,000 already and flying. So, you know, the extra time I've had on my hands has been quite beneficial in some respects. So, yeah, I've enjoyed that as well. So just trying to do what I can. And long walks, of course.
Yeah.
You know, so going out for a walk every day. Where I live is quite a nice part of the world. So, you know, so fortunate enough to be able to go for a walk down the beach. So I haven't bumped into Carlo yet, though. One day, maybe.
Yeah, I've spoken to a few people who live down that end who've been sort of walking up and down Crosby Beach just trying to catch a glimpse of him and see him counting the Iron Man and that sort of thing, but no sign as of yet. But that's great news on the book, and you know, it's something I've always, you know, whenever we've spoken and you know read your pieces for The Echo, I've always thought about why haven't you gone down that route. I mean, has it been an idea that's been rattling around in your head for a while?
Long time, yeah. I mean, a long time ago I did a it was called 10 Year Blues, and to be honest, it was a bit rubbish. It was just a collection of reports that I'd, you know, put in The Echo. And I always remember a review from the When Skies Are Grey, one of the guys said, yeah, it's all right, but, you know, we actually want the stories behind the stories. You know, we want to know how you came across this interview or your relationships with managers and players. And so it made sense, you know, that is far more interesting. And whenever I'm talking at work, you know, I'm one of the elder members of the sports desk now. So whenever I start telling stories, they all love the stories and like, oh, you've got to put this in a book. You've got to put it in a book. So I started doing it a long, long time ago. And as ever, time was always the constraint. I just thought I'll never really get around to doing it. I mean, I spoke to Gavin Buckland about his wonderful book he did about Everton in the 60s. I think it took him 7 years to do. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, it's good. I can't really commit to something like that. But start of the year, I just thought, right, I'm going to do it. And I started doing it. And I put together little cameos and little anecdotes going back several years. So I had probably about 10,000 words already in anecdotal form already together. So I started really putting my mind to it and really getting stuck into it at the start of the year. And because it's a project I'm quite passionate about, it's flown. You know, so it's not really a trial. It's something I'm actually enjoying doing. So yeah, it's been flying. So, you know, fingers crossed, July 31st, I'll get the completed manuscript and we'll start putting it together. And it could be in the market in time for Christmas when hopefully we'll all be out of this nonsense and able to go to shops and buy the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to that already. It sounds brilliant. And I think the stories behind the stories angle you mentioned there, it's something that I love it when we get to speak and you come on our shows, because some of the stories, you know, in particular about the 94-95 season on that special we did with you and Gav recently and Joe Royal, of course, was fantastic. And I suppose if you're looking at the industry now, and I'm sure, I imagine this will be something you'd be looking at, you know, in the book, it's those sort of things and those sort of anecdotes are getting less and less, aren't they? Because as you probably know better than anyone, that distance between journalists and, you know, the fans and the players is getting wider and wider. And you're not going to have things where you go on pre-season tours. You're not going to have that sort of interaction with the players on a day-to-day basis. So it's great that you'd be able to chronicle that all now.
Totally. I mean, I'm finding that even now. I mean, I'm up to the beginning of the Koeman era and the stories dry up because, you know, so football now is, or football journalism is conducted in a very controlled environment. I mean, I understand why. You know, when I first started doing the job, I was invited down to as Belfield once a day, if not twice a day. I'd sit down and have a conversation with the manager. I'd have like 10 or 15 minutes with him. I'd have a cup of tea, a bit of toast. And as a result, you build a relationship with that manager and you can understand what he's trying to achieve at the football club. And in some respects, you become friends. I had a number of players that lived quite close to me who became personal friends and still are now. So, you know, he ended up like going out socially with them. And a bizarre situation when Peter Johnson was the chairman at the time. And I remember the very first ground move poll back in about 94, I think it was. And myself and Paul Joyce had to go over to Johnson's house over in the Wirral to get the results of this ground poll move. And woman answered the door, and I just presumed she was Johnson's home help. You know, and she had a pinny on, and, you know, she was looked like she'd been doing a little bit of you know, sort of cleaning or something. Anyway, invited us into the kitchen, you know, gave me a glass of wine, kept on looking at me really oddly, you know, during the course of the interview. And eventually she goes, David Prentice, isn't this? You know, the penny dropped. Lorraine Rogers was an old school friend of mine.
For
a long, long time. Anyway, Johnson was appalled that, you know, so I knew, you know, so this girl who was my age, you know, so he was going out with. So that created a strange dynamic, you know, my relationship, you know, so the chairman at the time and his partner. And, you know, ultimately ended up on me spending the night on his yacht in the bloody south of France when I was writing some quite cruel, critical things about him, which were thoroughly justified, by the way.
Yeah.
And she tried to bury the hatchet by inviting me, joined the World Cup in 98, you know, so onto his yacht. So, you know, that's all in there. So, yeah, lots and lots of mad little anecdotes. But as you get closer to the modern era, they do tend to dry up a little bit because the change for me affected, apart from my own career, you know, so obviously I became deputy sports editor, then sports editor, so involved far more in the admin side of things than I would be actually writing as I used to. But football clubs themselves, when Everton moved to Finch Farm, I think they saw that as an opportunity to pull the drawbridge back up a little bit, you know, maybe not give us quite the same kind of access that we'd had previously. And they weren't doing it for, you know, so any ulterior motives. They're just the demands on managers', you know, time nowadays are intense.
Yeah.
So it is a very controlled environment. And nowadays, you know, so the Echo, along with all the other members of staff, get the opportunity to go and see the manager in a very controlled, you know, so press conference environment day before a football game. And we've got to try far harder to actually build the relationships that I was probably, you know, sort of granted much more easily when I was doing the job. Phil Kirkbride's doing a great job doing it. I mean, he's got very good contacts with Farhad Mashiri, you know, so the manager he's working on at the moment, but he's only new, you know, so it'll come. Marcel Brands, you know, so, but he's had to work a lot harder on it than maybe I did. But as a result, you know, so I did get a lot of very, very entertaining stories out of the job, which, you know, hopefully people enjoy reading.
Yeah, and I suppose it's one of them, isn't it, where it's just the very nature of football now, where you look at Everton in recent years, the turnaround in personnel at the football club has been, you know, in terms of the manager and the players and, you know, even on the board and stuff like that. It's been just a, you know, a revolving door, hasn't it? So I imagine for people, like you said, like Phil and Adam, we're at the Echo now for you guys, it must be hard for them to get those regular contacts because they could be in and out the door straight away.
Well, it's impossible. I mean, Ronald Koeman, I don't think anybody had his number. You know, he was a very, very, should we say, aloof individual anyway, who was, you know, sort of not wanting to build any relationships with the media. And he mistrusted us, basically. But, you know, I don't think anybody actually enjoyed having his, you know, private phone number. Again, I was quite fortunate when I started. There'd been like a precedent set in place by my predecessor, Ken Rogers, who was very close to Howard Kendall, and would go down every single day. And subsequent managers were just happy to continue with that arrangement. I took over in 93 when Howard was on his second spell, and obviously he was more than happy to, you know, to look after the Echo. And then obviously when he went, Mike Walker came in, and an interesting period in the club's history, but he was happy to continue with that arrangement. And then likewise Joe, likewise Walter, David Moyes. David gets this impression of a reputation, I think it's a bit unfair, of being quite a dour, you know, sort of cool individual. And okay, he's not exactly the life and soul of a party, as, you know, so Howard could be or Joe could be, but he was a very, very straight-dealing individual. And I've always said that he was the most honest man I ever dealt with as a manager, just absolutely straight as a die. Would always tell you everything utterly honestly. And the fact that he was there for so long as well, you know, so helped a great deal. So, you know, a fair bit of time for David as well. So, yeah, fortunate in many respects. But once he left, that was it then. It became like, you know, mayhem. I mean, Roberto got his 2 or 3 years, and Roberto was a strange character. I mean, you get this very outwardly, apparently very engaging and enthusiastic personality, but there was a slightly darker side to Roberto as well, which a lot of people didn't often see. And then when he went, it was like, you know, like you say, it was the roller coaster ride then, you know, sort of new manager every 12 months, which makes it very, very difficult indeed to get to know A, what a manager's trying to do, and B, get to know him particularly well at all. Fortunately, there's a bit more stability now, you know, certainly in the higher echelons of the club. I mean, you've got, you know, sort of a hierarchy that appears to be in place for quite some time to come. And hopefully that will extend to the manager as well, because I think, you know, we all agree that, you know, so Carlo is absolutely the right man for the job. And we hope that he's there for a long, long time to come.
Yeah, I bet your daily briefing with Carlo would be nice, wouldn't it?
It'd be wonderful,
to talk to every day.
It was funny, actually, because the first time I got to meet him, Bill had invited us into the boardroom for a game, his first match. And, you know, so brought me over to say hello to him. And I was trying to, like, score points as quickly as possible. So I referenced the fact that you made me a very, very happy man way back in 2007 when I was in Athens and you were the sports writer to cover the Champions League final, you know, against his Milan side. And he could see him looking at me thinking, sorry, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, obviously I work for the Liverpool Echo, but, you know, I've been an Evertonian all my life and I was there doing a professional job, but secretly rather hoping that, you know, so your team would win that night. So we've met him a few times since, and yeah, he comes across great. You know, so the players really appreciate him. Everybody at the club loves him. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, everything that he's trying to do is being interrupted by this, you know, so horrible business that's going on in the world. But, you know, so hopefully that'll be, you know, so over sooner rather than later, and he can get on with the job properly.
Yeah. Just finally on those daily meetings you used to have with the manager. So quickly, when did that stop? Was it when Moyes came in?
No. David was great. It wasn't quite as embracing as some of the other managers have been, in that, you know, I'd only get a cup of tea, you know, sort of once a week or twice a week and be invited up to his room, because he's very intense, David, and he always used to, you know, turn up and straight into the job, straight into, you know, what he wanted to do with that day. So I'd try and arrange it so I would get to Belfield before he arrived. You know, he normally got there about 8:15, depending on how his commute came from Preston down the M6. So I'd be there waiting for him, and then he'd always give me 5 or 10 minutes just in the little entrance hall at Belfield alongside that that radiator and the plaque that, you know, so celebrates the opening of Belfield, which was fine. That was all I needed, just an opportunity to bounce a few questions off him. But no, he was very, very good in that respect. It changed, like I say, when Everton moved to Finch Farm. And I think they said then, look, you know, we need to change this a little bit. We can't have you down here every single day. And I'd moved across to chief sports writing role then. I think it was Scott McLeod and Dominic King were taken over as the Everton writer. And they took the opportunity then to put us a little bit of a distance, maybe, you know, so not quite as much as some of the other newspapers, but, you know, so more so than we had been previously. And we had to accept that because, you know, unfortunately that was the nature of, you know, sort of journalism nowadays. So we had to do what we can to try and, you know, so, you know, get the stories that we could. And having said that, you know, David was always available, you know, so yeah, we had his number, we could ring him at any time. And like I said, he was always be 100% honest. So it wasn't so much an issue, really. It was when he went and Roberto came in, and, you know, we had to try really hard then to try and, you know, sort of embrace Roberto and, you know, sort of get to know him. And we did, but like I say, could be an odd individual at times, Roberto. You weren't quite sure that what you were getting told by Roberto was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yeah, I mean, we spoke to Leon Osman a couple of years ago, and he sort of said the same sort of thing about Roberto. It was a case of he'd tell you in meetings and speak to you and say, you're a key part of my plans, you know, you're going to be playing and all this sort of stuff. And Ozzy was saying he was effectively in his last season, and that wasn't the case. He's like, why are you saying that to me? But just on the chat you stuff with the manager, obviously that would have been, it was fantastic for you guys at the Echo and doing your report and stuff like that. Did you feel as though it was helpful for the managers as well, for you to sort of relay what people are saying and stuff like that? And maybe that's something now that would be helpful to someone like Carlo Ancelotti in particular, who's new to the football club. You've got that link between, you know, the main local press and him, and sort of, you know, transmitting that information back to him. It could be a major asset.
I've said this to people at Everton many times, it would be 100% because, you know, apart from the access that we get and, you know, sort of the quality of stories that we get, it allows you a very privileged insight into what's going on in the manager's mind. You know, you see him every day, therefore you get to know him and you hear about things that he's trying to implement and things that he's trying to do. And it's a difficult balancing act. You know, you've got to show a level of trust and, you know, you'll hear things that, you know, you'll know he doesn't want publishing. And so you've got to try and respect that, you know, which I think we did. But equally, you get, like I say, a little knowledge of what, you know, kind of things he's trying to do at the football club. And it just means that, you know, when you have a bad result, for instance, or a bad run, you treat it a little bit differently because you realise what the manager was trying to do, you know, so during that time. And you can see things a little bit more clearly. And I'm thinking really, you know, so during the Joe Royal era, when he had this incredible run where he started his Everton career, where an absolute miracle keeping Everton in the Premier League as it was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so winning the FA Cup. And I always remember a little anecdote of how we started, myself and Joe. I mean, I was at home one night and the phone goes at home and he goes, you know, so hello, pal, just letting you know that, you know, we've sold David Burrows to West Ham, I think it was, Coventry, 1.1 million. I thought, oh, right, okay. And I didn't know him. I just presumed that he'd rung around all the media. So I turn up for work the next day, pick up the morning papers, absolutely nothing in any of the papers. So he'd like basically dropped an exclusive in my lap. So wrote the story, went down to see him. I said, oh, I'll really appreciate that. I thought you were ringing everybody. He goes, oh, no, son, I've got a catchphrase, support your local sheriff. And I thought, wonderful. And so, you know, that was the start of, you know, start of a beautiful relationship. You know, it was, you know, so I love Joe to this day. And, you know, so we got on very, very well as a result of, you know, lots and lots of things. Came to a wedding, you know, he's, you know, a really, really good guy. So that when he had that, you know, sort of really sticky run at the start of 97 in January, I was very supportive because I knew what he was trying to do. I knew the injury problems that he had. You know, he'd lost Andy Hinchcliffe for a season. He'd lost Joe Parkinson, Dave Watson briefly. He was trying. He had a very, very thin squad anyway, you know, which he'd inherited, and he was still trying to build that up. And so I could see all this. I could see what he was trying to do. I could see, you know, the signings he was trying to bring in. And so that tempered what I was writing, and I was very, very supportive as a result. And I don't think that compromised me as a journalist, because I still genuinely believe that if Everton had have kept Joe, you know, so as manager, instead of this madness of mutually consenting him, the club would have been in a better place. We wouldn't have had that, you know, sort of ridiculous situation where Peter Johnson thought he was getting one manager and didn't, had to hold on for another. And then it ultimately ended up having to bring Howard back, you know, so for a third time. So it was a very, very curious time, but equally, I could see what Joe was trying to do, which was why I was supportive. And I think that bringing it right up to the modern day, I think that, you know, so if we were seeing the manager every single day, we would appreciate more, you know, so what he's trying to achieve and what he's doing. And the manager starts to trust you a little bit more as well and starts to, you know, sort of let you into his thinking and let you into his mindset. And so it tempers what you're writing. You know, so if you're going to be particularly critical of a particular player, maybe you wouldn't be because you realise, you know, so why he's been playing and why he's playing in the position that he is. Things like that, things that you probably wouldn't relate to a wider audience. Because when we do see the manager now, you know, so we're down at Finch Farm, when you have all the press, all the national press are there, Sky TV, the various television stations, the radio stations. You know, it's basically everybody turning up in the same room. And the manager naturally is going to be a little bit more guarded, I think, than he would be in an environment where it's just one-to-one. So, you know, I'll keep working on Emerson. You know, you never know. Maybe one day they'll you know, sort of let us have something approaching, you know, so what we had back in the day.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a really fascinating point about Joe and how, you know, you felt supportive of him, but you weren't compromised. And I suppose that's because you knew him and you knew what he was trying to do and you knew what he was like as a fella in that regard. And something we were speaking about on one of our shows last week in regards to the current manager and his staff. Obviously, the club put an interview out with David Angelotti. Yeah. Last week, and it was really interesting. He said a lot of really lovely things about the football club. He's clearly enjoying himself. We sort of related that back to Marco Silva's time at the football club.
Yeah.
And I sort of asked everybody, does anyone remember what his assistant's name was? And nobody really knew, because it felt as though him and his coaching staff tried to be quite sheltered and tried to keep himself away from all that. And then ultimately, when things did go wrong, people didn't really have that affinity with him and that connection with him, because I don't know whether it's he didn't want to portray himself and let the fans get to know him or his coaching staff, or the club just didn't do it. But one way or another, he just felt like a fella stood on the sidelines and not someone who we could relate to.
I think that was down to Marco himself, because, you know, I met him quite a few times and he was a very lovely, engaging guy. But he was very, very guarded. There was one lengthy sit-down that Brian Dugan, who was then the media officer at the club, had arranged for me. And as ever nowadays, it was controlled. You know, he sat in on the interview and had to listen to everything I was asking. But, you know, he wasn't trying to interrupt or trying to steer me in a certain direction. So it was, in effect, you know, sort of a general, you know, sort of informal conversation. And I had about 45 minutes with him. And, you know, he was good value. But every time I tried to steer him into something a little bit more intimate, he didn't want to know. You know, even to the point, well, where are you living? You know, you're bumping into Evertonians when you're walking around, wouldn't tell me, didn't want anybody to know anything about, you know, the inner workings of his life, which is fine. You know, so I understand how pressurised football management is and how managers maybe need to put a little bit of a drawbridge up. I mean, Ronald Koeman insisted on living in Cheshire, so he wouldn't be subjected to that kind of, you know, sort of that scrutiny. Yeah. But you contrast that to Carlo. He was like going down to Bootlestand shopping centre, who's so bumping into fans on the waterfront and mixing with them. It's almost as if he's looked at his predecessors and thought, well, hang on, you know, so the fans didn't appreciate that. They weren't happy with that. And he's not willing to make the same mistakes. You know, he's actually putting himself out there. He's, you know, basically treating himself, you know, as a fan, you know, so mixing with the supporters. And that does make a big difference. Like you say, people can relate to them a little bit more. And when things aren't going quite so well, and let's face it, Everton's a project that needs rebuilding, you know, so we need, you know, so a lot of, you know, work going on there. You know, so people are prepared to be a bit more patient because they see a man that actually shares the same values and shares the same, you know, sort of feelings that they have. So, yeah, very clever lad, you know, Carlo. He is actually, you know, so as you'd imagine, the man who's had the career he's had doesn't come by accident, you know, so he does it maybe because he's a very, very shrewd operator. But, yeah, it definitely works, 100%.
Just before we wrap up, Dave, I wanted to speak about something else with you as well. I know you're massively into your boxing. I just want to see, have you seen the videos of Mike Tyson doing the rounds? Back in training again?
Oh, I saw something on Twitter this morning saying, Boxing News sent something out saying the worst aspect of nostalgia now is the possibility of Tyson coming back. And I just dismissed it. I'll look at that later. But that's genuinely a tale doing the rounds, that he might be making a comeback of sorts.
There's been some videos. There's been some videos of him doing training, and he looks very sharp in them. But I suppose these videos of boxers, you know, sometimes if you know they're a bit speeded up and stuff like that when they're training, they're obviously not getting hit back or anything like that. But I think he put on one of his social media things a hint of a comeback or something like that. But the man's, you know, 52 years old now. I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on it, but
it's exactly the same as the thoughts I had with Nigel Benn, you know, so it was making his comeback, you know, sort of last year. It's tragic. You know, I suppose you can look at the fact that it was George Foreman won the world heavyweight title at 46, and you saw, you know, Tommy Hearns kept going to a ripe old age. But, you know, boxing is the most brutally unforgiving sport, you know, sort of imaginable out there. It's dangerous. I sat down having this conversation with Tony Bellew, you know, many times, you know, sort of towards the end of his career. I feared for him against David Hay. I really did, and showed you what I know about boxing. But no, I genuinely did, because heavyweights, you know, it just takes one punch, and you know, it's not just, you know, so your fight ended, your life could be ended. And you know, he totally got the risks inherent in it. But the rewards outweighed that. And having beaten David Hay once, I thought, great, that's it. You know, you can now, you know, so call it a day as a heavyweight. But he saw the opportunity to make a lot more money in the rematch. And I said to him, you know, why do you want to do this? You know, you've got a wife, you've got kids, you've made money. And it's a drug sometimes, boxing. It gets into you and it's very, very difficult to get away from it. And, you know, so people just keep boxing far more than they should do. Muhammad Ali, my all-time idol, you know, so in any sport, went on far longer than he ever should have done. And it was tragic what happened to him, you know, so right in the end, you know, the Larry Holmes fight with that horrible little tinny bell in the Bahamas. You know, so legends don't know when to say no. And Mike Tyson is a legend, you know, so I think ultimately his claims to be like the greatest boxer of all time, you know, so were exposed, you know, when Buster Douglas stood up to him. And then, you know, when people realized that he was fallible.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he, if you did confront, you know, so, you know, the monster head on, you know, so you could possibly, you know, so get out of there, you know, so with some kind of, you know, something intact. But for 3 or 4 years, you know, he was an absolute force of nature. And I remember the night he lost to James Buster Douglas, and it was in Japan, it was in the wee small hours, like 4 o'clock, and I hadn't stayed up to watch it. And a mate came round, you know, so to the house, oh, have you heard? So Tyson has lost. I refused to believe it. No, he's lost. Yeah, well, what did he lose? I'm thinking it might have been a flash knockout in the first round, 10th round knockout. And as soon as I heard 10th round, I thought, impossible, Tyson can't last 10 rounds. And so that was what he was like, you know, so the aura that surrounded the man back then, that was dented by that defeat and by the subsequent experiences that he had. And it's never going to come back now, so I don't know what he thinks he can possibly achieve by coming back. It'll be a circus show, it'll be a freak show, and I'd rather not see it, to be honest. I didn't want to see Nigel Benn get back into a ring again, and I certainly don't want to see Mike Tyson get back in.
Yeah, I mean, there's been talk about a few boxers maybe coming back during all this, you know, the lockdown and stuff like that. And you just wonder, with financial constraints and with them being home and doing home training and that sort of thing, and being in that bubble, that we might see a few of that when this all ends. And like you said, it's just a bit horrible, isn't it? Just to see someone like that go through it again.
Well, you've got memories, you know, so you remember, you know, so how these people were. Funnily enough, I got a message yesterday on Facebook Messenger from a fella called Glenn Feldman, who was, he still is, a very, very highly respected judge. He's done the Fury Wilder fights. He's done he's done Mayweather, God knows how many times, you know, so a really regarded, you know, judge. But I got to know him when he did Shane Earie, Andy Holligan, way back in the day when he did the Narc in the Park in 96, I think it was. And that was an absolutely incredible contest. You know, so 6 rounds of absolute intensity, you know, akin with Hagler Hearns, really it was. It was absolutely wonderful. And doesn't quite get the profile it deserves because it was a domestic fight, effectively, rather than an international fight. Remember the BBC at the time, you know, so their radio guys, John Rawlings, was it, basically screaming down the phone to his bosses, please don't undersell this. This is an incredible fight. And at the end of the contest, Glenn Feldman turned round to where the press bench was, and I won't do the American accent because I can't, but you know, he just drawled, that is the greatest fight I've ever seen. Anyway, so I used that in my piece, and he read it, and he was quite pleased about it, and I just kept in touch. So sadly, the upshot, he became a Liverpool fan as a result of his visit to Merseyside. Follows Liverpool Football Club, but he keeps in touch and you know, does all these great fights. But yeah, you know, you have memories of these fights and these fighters, you know, so as they were. I mean, one of the greatest nights at Goodison will be Tony Bellew winning the world title against Ilunga Makabu. That was an incredible night, helped by the fact that the weather was perfect, everything about it was great. But you know, another little, you know, so ticking, you know, so Goodison's, you know, so long and storied history. But these are memories, and you know, memories can be sullied and can be spoiled by things that happen subsequently. I'd rather nothing happen to sully the memory of Mike Tyson. He's got enough skeletons in his closet without taking any more to it.
Yeah, but that's a brilliant note to finish on. Dave, we'll wrap it up there. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Half an hour has absolutely flown by.
Enjoyed it.
Be great to get you back on to chat about your book when that inevitably gets going again. We'll go into a bit more detail on that. In the meantime, thanks to everybody for watching this. If you enjoyed this video, go back and watch the rest of the ones we've done. Yesterday, I spoke to former England international Sue Smith, who a lot of people think is a red. Did you know she was a blue, Dave?
No, I watched that yesterday, actually. No, I had no idea. You've educated me there. It was very good, though. Yeah, I urge people to watch that one as well.
She said to me after we recorded that people come up to her in the supermarket and go and start talking about Liverpool, thinking she's a red. She's like, no, I'm a blue. So,
well, not across to bear, that is.
Yeah, I spoke to Kevin Ratcliffe last week as well. Yeah. One more video coming up this week on Friday. I speak to Andy Burnham, Manchester Mayor, big Evertonian as well. So watch out for that tomorrow. But thanks very much today, and I'll speak to you soon.
Progressive presents Forced Metaphors, about bundling your home, auto, and other vehicles.
Any sports fan knows defense wins championships. Your championship is your boat, motorcycle, RV, or ATV. And your best defense is the round-the-clock protection offered by Progressive, which is like having a goalie, a 7-foot shot-blocking specialist, and a linebacker all wrapped into one. Which, to circle back, means you're going to win the championship. Because, you know, defense.
Forced Metaphors, presented by Progressive. Bundle and protect today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Discount not available in all states or situations.
Sports Social Podcast Network.